briefly, what's the mission of J.F. Ingram State Technical College?
Well, we have an exciting mission. We work with incarcerated adults, both men and women. We offer adult basic education, vocational skills training, soft skills training, those kind of skills necessary to help them transition from where they are inside the prison, hopefully to success outside the prison. And that's all we do. 100% of what we do is working with incarcerated males and females.
Now, the fact that it's part of the Alabama two-year college system, that seems unique to me. And this facility, I mean, this institution's been around for a while, right?
1965 is when it first stood up as an institute, and later in our history became a part of the Alabama two-year college system. I think it's a great place to do correctional education. Most of my contemporaries across the nation are actually a part of the Departments of Corrections or similar agencies within those states. So it's just a different kind of look and feel when you're a part of the Department of Corrections. The emphasis for Department of Corrections obviously is security issues first. Other things will follow after that. Our primary emphasis is education and training. So all of our faculty and staff, we're thinking about human development. We're thinking about education. We're thinking about training. Now, that's not incompatible with security, but it's a different perspective that I think when combined with DOC's security perspectives makes us an ideal partner to work with incarcerated individuals.
Okay. Now, that it is a unique approach, but the way you just explained it, it seems to make a lot of sense. Why do you think it's so unique? Why do you think other states don't do it this way?
You know, I've been exploring that. I've been in this job for a little over 2 years now, and I've gone to the National Correctional Education Association conferences. And when I talk with my counterparts, they express envy over the way that we're set up. Now, we're not in a perfect world, but it is a different kind of rule set that you deal with based on your organizational alignment. I'm not exactly why other states choose it to do the way they do it. The state of Kentucky, for example, has gone back and forth over the years, where at times the correctional education staff was a part of the Department of Corrections and at times a part of their equivalent Department of Post-Secondary. Currently, they're under the Department of Corrections. So they've gone back and forth. There are probably political issues. There are probably views about who best should own the education and training and rehabilitation, if you will. I mean, think about it. Education and training is a part of the rehabilitation package. And so Department of Corrections is responsible for rehabilitation. So I guess in some perspective, in some view, it would make sense that we would be a part of the Department of Corrections. I think we've got it right in the state. I do. I think it's good for our faculty and staff to be a part of a larger organization whose primary focus, whose predominant concern is developing human beings in an educational and training kind of way. It gives us an opportunity to partner with those direct connections. It gets an opportunity for us, for example, to take advantage of new instructor institutes that are offered by the larger system. So there are a lot of opportunities that are available to us by having this direct partnership that I'm not sure would be as readily available and certainly wouldn't. Some of them are free. Most of them are free to us. So I think that's a great advantage to us.
What brought you personally into this line of work?
This is my bucket list job. I have grown up my entire life. I mentioned I'm retired Air Force, but my entire career has been in the education and training field. And I have been developing ideas about how to educate and how to run organizations that are in the business of educating and development and training. And so this was my opportunity, really, to be the chief executive officer of an organization that did that. And I be honest with you, when I first applied for the job, I don't think I really understood completely that their job was developing inmates. And when I realized that, it kind of took me aback. And so I was kind of surprised by that. And then as I thought more about it, I became more and more excited because the opportunities to develop people in this way, to give them a second chance or a third chance, maybe some of them their last chance at redemption and the ability to return to society, gave me goosebumps. So education's a calling anyway. And so even as I talk about it now, you know, I again get excited about the idea of educating those that we generally have given up on, perhaps, that society maybe has said there's no hope. And we're in the business of hope restoration. We're in the business of redemption. We're in the business of helping people transform their lives and develop them into responsible citizens so that they can return to society. They can return to their communities, to their families, and maybe break that cycle of what got them in prison in the first place.
Speaking of that, I understand that, you know, when you came on the job, you said roughly 2 years ago, something that you came in with was to focus, to add some focus to life skills, you know, getting along with other people, how to get up, set an alarm clock, get to work on time, that kind of thing, as opposed to just vocational education. Tell me a little bit about A, how you came to realize that that's important or why you think that's important, and B, how does that translate into what y'all actually do right here?
Yeah, it's a great question. So, one of the things that I believe is true is that education is good. More education is gooder, if that's a word. And so the idea that we would provide education, adult basic education, I think is a good thing to any individual, particularly to people that have not experienced probably much success in the education system. I think it's true. I think it's also true that many of our students, our inmates, had jobs before they came to us. Many of them are skilled craftsmen, and that's not what put them in prison in the first place. And so I began to think, even before I got here, really, as I thought about coming here, was that job skills are great, but job skills alone are not enough. Education is good. Education alone is not enough. And as I began to think about the people that I knew over the course of my life, including relatives that have gone sideways with the law, what got them in trouble was not their ability or inability to do a job. Some of them had education. What got them into a jam was their inability to manage their life. In the business world, they call this soft skills. It's life skills. It's business skills. But it's basically, how do you work through conflict effectively? Because we're all going to experience it. That's not the issue. The issue is how are we able to work through it to positive outcomes on the other side? What are the strategies we use? How do we deal with authority? How do we get along with our boss? How do we communicate effectively? How do we work and play well as a part of a team? How do we manage our personal finances? How do we manage stress in our life? And really what you find in a lot of the students here is that they have this cumulative effect, if you will, of a remarkable inability to do any of those things very well. And so I think it becomes tremendously important that we focus on three legs of the stool: adult basic education, vocational skills, and life skills or soft skills. Absent any one of those legs, the stool falls over. And when the stool falls over, we call that recidivism, where an inmate returns to society, is unable to make it, and they return to prison because they've committed a new crime or they violated a parole condition.
As far as the context of the program, you know, this is a very sort of tough on crime state, very fiscally conservative state. Tell me a little bit about the context, the budgetary hurdles, you know, what J.F. Ingram faces as far as just doing what you're calling is what you want to do and what all your staff, you know, all your educators want to do. What are some of the hurdles and obstacles that you deal with?
Yeah, I think the attitude of the general population is one that is probably not patient with people behind bars, fairly judgmental. It tends to be a very conservative population, and with that kind of conservative bent comes this idea that we ought to be tough on crime. And I guess I'm kind of okay with being tough on crime if that means holding people responsible, if that means holding people accountable, if that means exacting logical consequences for your behavior. I think where I have a difficulty with it, if we put so many barriers up that there's no ability to return when return is possible, then we're not tough on crime, we're dumb on crime. And I think Senator Cam Ward has started coining a phrase that's called smart on crime. And I think what we ought to do is be smart on crime. And I think being smart on crime doesn't mean we have to be easy. I don't think it means that we don't have to hold people accountable. I don't think that it means that we don't have to have consequences. But I think we ought to understand what works and what doesn't work in terms of rehabilitation, in terms of corrections. And in that sense, there's no longer a mystery about what works and what doesn't work. And, you know, what we do know, and there's a recent study from the RAND Corporation, which is a national think tank. In fact, they're very much international in terms of doing research and studies that helps inform decision makers about policies and strategies. And they've done some great work in the area of corrections and recently released a report about what works in correctional education. And it's clear that correctional education makes a difference. that it stands a better chance of helping people find employment, that there's a greater likelihood that they will be able to get out of prison and stay out of prison. In other words, it reduces recidivism. And that, in fact, it can pay for itself. There's a $5 or $4 or $5 return for every dollar you invest in correctional education in terms of three-year corrections cost. So I think that tough on crime is interesting, and I think it's an oversimplification to a very complex problem. And the complexity of the problem starts with sentencing. In fact, you can back it up. It starts with what we do in society in terms of whether or not we fund education properly in the first place in the outside world, whether or not we pay attention to at-risk students, whether or not we pay attention to poverty, the impact it has on families. And then after you do that, and after people begin to make mistakes in their lives, how do you sentence them? And what happens to you to them when you sentence them and put them behind bars? And what happens during the corrections process, the rehabilitative process? What happens in the pardon and parole process? So all of those work together, and I think it's going to take a comprehensive solution where tough on crime just doesn't cut it. It falls short. We need smart on crime.
Well, speaking of smart on crime, there's a legitimate threat that the federal Department of Justice could take over Alabama's correctional system. That being the case, and you've got very conservative politicians, very conservative legislators sort of saying, hey, we need to be smart on crime. They're making sort of fiscal arguments for what I'm guessing you and many other people would say is also a moral and ethical duty or issue. Are you hopeful that that takeover could be averted?
I think we're at a crossroads. We're at an important point in the state of Alabama, and I think the nation is going to watch what we do. And are we going to be the Alabama of old that thinks in kind of our old ways of doing things? Are we going to kind of rear up and say, don't tread on me? Or are we going to really open ourselves up to new ways of thinking about a problem? And so I'll be watching with interest what the state legislature does. It was only 2 years ago that this state legislature cut our prison education budget statewide by 12.5%. And 2 years ago, we knew we had problems in the prison system. This was not new 2 years ago. And so it's curious to me that in the face of knowing that we have troubles in our prisons and knowing that correctional education can help if they really believe that, that we would cut the very program that stands to have the greatest positive effect and at the greatest return on investment. So I'll be watching now what happens next and to see if there is a change in thinking. But I also am watching as a realist, knowing that the general population is averse to spending money on prisons and inmates, and in particular averse to spending on education. You see the comments all the time on the web and on blogs about giving free education to rapists and murderers and that kind of stuff. And again, that's, emotionally very powerful. And in a political election in particular, it carries some weight. So we can't ignore the pressure that our politicians are under where that kind of public opinion could lead them away from actually doing what's best for the state and for the safety of the community, really, because we need to understand that nationally, the Bureau of Justice statistics point out clearly that about 95% of everybody behind state prison bars today are going to get out. The question is how will we send them?
When I saw some of the I was lucky enough to witness some of these life skills classes at Tutwiler Prison being taught by Rick Vest and Amanda Pittman, it seemed like these women were really facing hard issues about their own past behavior, about themselves. I mean, it definitely wasn't coddling. I saw that myself, and I thought what they had to say was very interesting. They seemed so very introspective. They were sort of taking advantage of this reset point, like, oh, my God, I've really messed up. I'm in here. But now I'm away from my addiction, or I'm away from the group of people I used to be with and who always sort of got into trouble. And they could step back and really think. But one thing I also noticed, it seemed like there were a lot of women in that facility who could have benefited from this kind of life skills, sort of self-reflection and all the stuff that you all are doing. But there just aren't enough people available to teach them now. So what is the budgetary situation? Is the lack of money, is it really as straightforward as y'all don't have enough money to reach the people that you could?
Yeah, it's pretty simple, really. This is not complicated. It is a matter of funding. The college, unlike other colleges, we have no capacity for bringing in revenue. because we don't have paying students, generally speaking. So our students don't pay tuition and fees. Most of them cannot pay tuition and fees. We have a very small number that will pay for a second trade or a second educational program, which is required by state board policy. If they take a second one, they have to pay for it. But the vast majority of our students really are unable to pay. And so we receive an allocation from the state. We receive two different kinds of allocations in order to do our mission. One is our regular operations maintenance allocation from the Department of Post-Secondary to do our business, and then a special prison education allocation from the state legislators that is a line item in the budget that when you combine those, we get a little over $6 million a year to do our business. The vast majority of that pays for faculty, staff, and salaries. In fact, if it were not for grant money from the federal government and in some cases state grants, we wouldn't be able to execute our mission at all. We're over 30% dependent on state and federal grants. If those went away, we'd have to essentially close our doors. So it is about dollars at the end of the day. We do not have the capacity to raise revenues. So if it does not come from the state allocation or appropriation system, then we won't have the money. If we get more students, we just get more students. We don't get additional revenue. In a traditional community college, if they have additional students, it comes with additional tuition and other fees. For us, that's not the case. So more students just means more students. So what we have done is we, in the first 2 years that I've been here, we've tried to gain every efficiency we can. We've tried to cut programs that were not performing well, save money from, you know, turning in vehicles we weren't driving that much to save insurance costs, which was very, very small, to shutting down a program. In fact, we shut down two programs that were not performing well based on standards, and we're saving that money, and that is the money that we're using to try to stand up a life skills program. But it's inadequate funding. We only had enough money to start the program at Tutwiler, where it seemed to be the greatest need. But Tutwiler is a very small part of the population. That's the population of women that we serve. Relatively speaking, it's very small compared to the men, and there is just a great need to serve the men in this way, but funding keeps us from doing that.
Are you hopeful your allocation from the state legislature might go up?
I was, and I'm not sure, because I've communicated fairly strongly in July. I got here in May of 2012. In July of 2012, I actually wrote a pretty detailed report about our funding challenges. And it was the subsequent fiscal year that our funding got cut. So I said, not a great report. So I need to enhance my communication skills, perhaps. So I've communicated again, and this year we're receiving another cut. And the cut is significantly smaller, but it's still a cut nonetheless. And so stunned may be too strong of a word, but I was certainly surprised that in light of all of the evidence, and if we're talking about evidence-based decision-making about the effectiveness of correctional education, how in the world do we cut the program that stands the best chance of getting people out of the overcrowded prison and into a situation where they won't come back? So it's a little puzzling to me. I will be watching. I mean, the conversation tone and intensity is ratcheted up in terms of about our apparent commitment as a state. So we'll see if that's backed up. Now, I know that there are limited funds in the state of Alabama. I know the general fund is fairly broken. Our funding comes from the Education Trust Fund, and it seems to be a little bit better off than the general fund. But still, there's not, you know, money enough to do everything that we want to do. And so I know the state decision makers have to be very careful about the decisions they make and can they fund those decisions. You know, I have a bit of a narrow perspective, I confess, and my passion is here. But this one seems to be a little easy to me. In a state where we spend over $450 million a year to house 26,000 inmate, dividing the math, that's about $17,000 per year per inmate that it's costing us. And if the evidence from outside research, not our own, suggests you can get the return, financial return on investment, much less human return on investment, it seems to me to be a little bit easier decision to fund that. That hasn't happened yet, so I'll be waiting to see what will happen in the upcoming legislative session.
Let's say you had a way to communicate directly to the voters who elect these representatives who always have to worry about, you know, serving their constituents and getting reelected, whatever their main concerns may be. if a voter were to say to you, well, there are a lot of schools, regular schools, for kids who haven't broken the law yet. They're having trouble, you know, getting textbooks and having PE class. How do you respond to that? Why should we fund people who have already gotten in trouble, already broken the law?
Yeah, so it's always a good question, and I've actually gotten that question. I've spoken to many civic groups and continue to do that because I want to try to shape that thinking. The question itself poses an artificial dichotomy. What it says is either or. And what I'm suggesting is and both. We have to figure out a way to do and both. It is right and proper to fund education in the free world and to make sure that our children have transportation and books and good teaching and all that kind of stuff. But I don't think that means that we shouldn't look at creative ways to figure out a way to change the way that we're doing business in terms of corrections and rehabilitation, because what we're doing now is not working. And, you know, I think it was Einstein that said, you know, the true measure of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. We cannot afford to do that. I would have a conversation that says that what we're doing is fiscally, financially irresponsible, and that it's an economically unsustainable model to think about building new prisons, which have a horrible price tag, estimates anywhere from $100 to $400 million just to build them, much less to sustain those. And those are medium security prisons, not high security prisons. That's a different animal when you go to high security. So I think it's, you know, fiscally irresponsible not to have this conversation and try to figure out a way to do this, particularly when we take a look at some facts. If we can get away from the emotion just a second and get to the facts I've already mentioned, like 95% of them are going to get out. Facts like 33 to 67% will come back to the prison again if we don't do things differently. And taxpayers are footing that bill now. Prisons are trailing only Medicaid in terms of the most expensive bill that the general fund is supporting right now. So we have to think about the problem, I think, in more complex ways because it's a complex problem.
And, of course, there's the whole ethical moral dimension.
Well, absolutely. I think it's troubling when we think that the United States is number one in the world in rates of incarceration, that Alabama is third in the United States, which probably puts us somewhere up in the top five in the world in terms of rates of incarceration. And I don't think Alabama has any more wicked people than any other state or any particular place in the world. So what's going on? I think we need to ask ourselves that question. So, yeah, I think you're absolutely right.
Tell me a little bit about the people of J.F. Ingram. How many educators are on staff? And also, if you could just sort of, I know it's hard to sum up a lot of people quickly, but, you know, who are these people? Why do they do what they do?
Yeah, they're an interesting lot. We have about 130 at our 9 instructional sites across central Alabama. J.F. Ingram is responsible mainly for central Alabama. We go as far north as Donaldson Correctional Facility at Bessemer, and Red Eagle and Kilby out towards south and east. Then there are 4 other community colleges that have the north and the south responsibilities, but they do that kind of as a part-time mission. They do it on the side. We do it full-time. So we have 130 strange people here, and I say strange because they come and they never leave. And why is that? What would make – and not everybody comes, by the way. I'll interview some people. I interviewed a gentleman one time and selected him for the position. And 2 days later, he said he couldn't do it. And no, nothing against him, but he just couldn't do it. He couldn't wrap his mind around spending every day of his life with people that were behind bars. And so I think the answer to the question of what are these people like are, I think, convicted, but in a different way. I think they're convicted that it's the right thing to do. I think they're convicted that human beings have a redemptive quality about them, most people. Now, some people are just maybe beyond redemption, but the vast majority that we're talking about here are people that are redemptive, have a redemptive part to their nature, and our faculty and staff believe that. And so I think they're dedicated to it. I mean, I literally retired an individual that was here over 30 years, and it was his first job out of high school, and he never left.
What was the job? What did he do?
He was a plumbing instructor. Now, he wasn't a plumbing instructor initially. He was doing something else. He was apprentice, and he grew, and he developed, and he turned into an instructor, and he was here for 30-something years as our plumbing instructor, did a great job. They just don't leave. If it gets inside your blood and inside your soul, you come to believe that if I can just turn one person around, in fact, I challenge my faculty and staff, make an impact. If you just do one person a semester, even just one a year, and we multiply that times 130, you know, think of the effect we'll have on the communities and across the state. If that doesn't get your emotions going, if that doesn't get you excited, you probably ought to check your pulse. So that's who they are.
So as far as you mentioned the research and the RAND Corporation, I gather they've done research that shows correctional education in general reduces recidivism. That's correct, right?
Sort of. What they actually did was an interesting research approach. They did a meta-analysis of existing research, and that can be very powerful. So they basically looked at research that's been done for years and years and years. And first of all, they sorted the wheat from the chaff. They discarded the research studies that were not sound. They only looked at the most powerful research studies. And it was by looking at the most powerful research studies that they drew their conclusions on. The best of the best is what they drew their research on. And so that suggests when things are working well and when studies are done right, we get this nice effect. And it's fairly consistent and it's fairly predictable. And that is correctional education makes people better. It helps them get a job when they get out, and it helps them stay out after they've been out, and it has a nice financial return on investment for whatever state invests properly in it. But that's if it's done properly. That's if there's a proper investment in the correctional education. At some point, you have to reach this investment if you're going to really get the return that you want. It's kind of like investing in your retirement. If you invest a dollar a year in your retirement, you're not going to get much of a return. And at some point you say, what is the use in investing that? Because it's not going to pay off in the end. You have to invest a certain amount. Any investor will tell you this. You have to invest a certain amount in order to reach that tipping point where you get that nice return. I don't think we're there yet as a state. I think we can do better, and I think we can bring more powerful results, results that the RAND Corporation is talking about. But it's going to take a commitment, and it's going to take a steady state investment in order to be able to reach that tipping point where we get that nice return on investment.
What does doing it correctly mean? What are some characteristics of a correctional education program that works?
That's a great question. I think it's making sure that you have adequate numbers of faculty and staff, that you have the right programming in place. The life skills, soft skills piece is very critical, and that you have enough of a presence to reach enough of the students that you have available to you. Right now we have, I think, 26 major correctional facilities across the state, and we're not near at all of them. We're just at a few of them. Even the place where we are now, we can't get to all the students that we can get to. Some programs in the state have waiting lists for their adult basic education program. So I think we have to make that investment so we can access more of the students, more of the time, with more of the right programs. That's the investment we need.
Okay, so there's research that shows the sort of return on investment and the benefits of correctional education. Your pilot program at Tutwiler, which is what's new about it, is the focus on life skills as opposed to just vocational education. How will you know if that's working? Because it's so new. I mean, I understand that y'all are keeping track of data from the start. How will you know whether that's working?
Well, one of the things we're doing is we're going to be tracking recidivism. The rate by which people leave and then don't return, that's probably one of the biggest ones that we ought to be concerned about in the state. Recidivism is interesting, though, just as an aside, because you don't know what you don't know. We track recidivism as a function of people that return. We don't really know what happened to the people that don't return. Did they get lost? Did they move away? Are they still behaving badly? So, you know, that's an issue. So we'll track that. We'll track specific programs, program outcomes. So that could be involved in terms of doing a survey in terms of their attitudes and skills before their training and then a survey afterwards. We also have a nice instrument that we are adapting from the state of Ohio. It's called the Ohio Risk Assessment Survey, and that talks about risks for recidivating. And so we'll be able to determine kind of in a pre-experience fashion where they are in terms of their risk for recidivating. And then we can also administer that instrument post-experience, and hopefully we'll get a nice return there. So those are the kinds of things, and not all of them, but the kinds of things that we'll be doing to try to make sure we're able to track that result.
If you all got a bump in your allocation from the state legislature next time around, would some of that money, would it be right for me to assume that at least some of that money would go to the pilot life skills program?
Yeah, we would expand that program. We would restore something that we've had to cut, which pained me deeply to have to make that cut.
What was that?
Well, we're currently not offering any college degrees. We're a two-year technical college, and we've suspended our two-year degree offerings in order to save money.
So what are you doing then? I don't understand.
That's a great question. What we're offering is short-term and long-term certificates and GEDs. Now, those have always been a staple of every technical college. Do we have people completing their adult basic education and getting a GED, high school equivalency, a short-term certificate in a particular vocation, a long-term certificate in a particular vocation? So those things are ongoing. But what we're not doing is, for example, offering an applied associate's and technology degree in HVAC or in office information or drafting design and technology. And there is some research to suggest that, in fact, degrees are important. You know, one of the things that research has indicated is that, and this is the old rule of thumb, more education is better. And we know that inmates that have degrees fare better than those that don't have degrees. Education is good, but again, you have to make that investment in order to get the full return on that investment. So right now, within this past year, we've had to suspend offering our AET degrees because it saved us about four faculty positions, which are essential to the academic portion of those degrees.
Right. So you're a portion of the two-year college system, and you're not offering two-year college degrees.
That's currently the case.
Okay. You would think that might sort of trigger a little bit of interest in lawmakers, right?
I'm not sure that lawmakers are aware that we've done that. Certainly my leadership is. And I think they dislike that as much as I do. The reason we're a part of the two-year college system is because we're supposed to be a degree-granting entity. As it stands now, for the moment, unless our funding changes, we're a trade school. I think I would like for that to change. I'm quite sure the chancellor would like that to change. But again, that's a function. You can't – when I came here, we were at deficit spending, the college was. It took me a couple of months to figure out, but we were at deficit spending. And then remember, it was right after that that we received a 12.5% cut. That was a $331,000 cut to this college alone, $750,000 statewide. And this year I'm facing another $20-something thousand cut. A net cut of about $10,000. But again, that's not like a lot of money, it doesn't sound like. But when you're talking about a not a lot of money, it makes a huge difference. You know, you're talking about a program. You're talking about a part-time faculty member, perhaps. You're talking about the ability to buy materials for a program. All of those things are important. So we started in the hole, really. And the hole has gotten deeper since we've been here. And in the face of that, we're trying to, you know, one of the commitments I made to the state and to the chancellor is that we would be as efficient as we could to make sure that we were being good stewards of the taxpayers' money. We have that as an obligation. And that we would do everything we could to save money, to be efficient. And only then would I come to him. And so I've gone to him.
The work crews that I saw going out, what kind of work are they going out to do?
Depends on where they're traveling to. Sometimes it will be routine maintenance for state agencies, office buildings, and things like that. Sometimes they're a part of a road crew that's going to go on a Department of Corrections construction project or something like that. So any number of things could happen. Actually, I believe that private individuals can hire them to do projects, and they go out under supervision. And I'll just give you one example. There's a realtor I know that will hire crews to come and do maintenance around houses, and they pay. And DOC actually earns a portion of those wages, and the inmate earns a portion of those wages, and they kind of go on the inmate's books for them to be able to use for personal items and the like. So work release is a very attractive option for inmates. I will tell you, it works against us, actually, because as soon as they're eligible for work release, they may leave our program, and they may not be finished with our program. And so we have a challenge trying to help the inmates see the long-term consequences of making a short-term decision about money now versus the long-term benefits of education. So that's one of those issues.
Yeah, it comes up a lot in life, doesn't it?
It really does.
Interesting. You mentioned before you had some family members that got in trouble with the law a while back. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
This is a tough one. I have I have relatives, and I don't want to say too much more than that, that I've seen in their life. One of them is a convicted felon. Two great examples, and one of them is involved in drugs. So two relatives. And the person involved in drugs got involved in criminal activity to support the drug habit. Absent the drug habit, my belief is he wouldn't commit the crime. So every time we put a drug offender behind state bars, we have to ask the question, is that really the best way to treat that problem? Now, of course, there's a crime there, but at the root cause of the crime, if you want to really understand and deal with the root cause, the person is not dealing with their life well. In fact, some of the things I talked about, dealing with authority, relationship issues, problem solving, critical thinking, all sorts of things like that are going on with both of these relatives, and even now they're struggling with them. The other relative that's the convicted felon has an alcoholism problem. But the alcoholism is there to self-medicate the fact that he cannot deal with life. He can't deal with life stressors, a series of failed marriages, a series of failed jobs. And really at the heart of that are the very same things in these two relatives of mine who I love dearly that my inmate students struggle with. It's the inability to manage their life. And it's those things that led them to make decisions that ended up getting them in a jam. And I will tell you, neither one of them will benefit from vocational skills training alone. In fact, one relative is a highly qualified industrial maintenance person, which is a very much in demand job now to do industrial maintenance. It's a very high, well-paid position in the blue-collar area. That's not what he was very good at. That's not what got him in trouble on the job. What got him in trouble on the job was he had attitude problems and had, you know, trouble with the bosses all the time, trouble working and playing well with others. But he was very good technically at what he did. That is exactly what happens here, and that's why, you know, just from that, I will tell you, there's one other piece that I haven't disclosed. My background is clinical psychology. And so I have the opportunity to work and had the opportunity to work with a lot of people in clinical settings and to see the kind of distorted thinking that led to self-destructive behaviors, which is exactly what is going on with inmates here. Virtually a 100% have kind of this distorted thinking pattern. In fact, they have their own name for it, and they call it stinking thinking. And they realize it, and they have insight about it, but they have troubles combating it, particularly when things are going bad for them. And then the behaviors become self-reinforcing. So as we think about, you were talking about the students at Tutwiler that are having greater insight. Insight alone is not enough. We need to help them develop new ways of being, new ways of coping, new behavioral strategies, and then provide a social network for them to go in so they don't go back to the same environment that they had the problem with. You know, you can work with somebody, but if they go right back to those friends or that situation, that will be more powerful than the work that we've been able to do with them. So that speaks to the transition out phase, which we're also working on, is to try to transition them in. And there are some great research projects going on nationwide and grant funding that we've been unable to access so far. For example, the state of Michigan, where they're setting up communities across the state that will serve as support networks to transition inmates back into to increase the chance that they will get out, be successful, and stay out. We need to do that kind of thing in the state.
So the experiences of some of your family members, does that maybe help you not see these inmates as other?
I think that, and probably my background as a counselor and psychologist for so long, you know, I have a fundamental belief that human beings can change and that they can think about things differently. I think some individuals need more help than others. I think we're in the business of this already. I mean, anytime we open up a school, we're saying that we can grow individuals, that we can shape individuals, that we can help them become productive citizens. And what we have here are citizens that derailed. And so the question is will we invest to get them back on track again, to help them to a better future? And if we can do that, it's not just good for them, but it's good for society. And I think it's the right thing to do.
You mentioned you were a trainer, an Air Force pilot trainer. Is that right?
No, I was just an education and training business. The Air Force is real big into education and training of their force, not just in vocational skills, oddly, but in things like leadership skills and followership skills. I was in that business.
Okay. What was your first job where you were an educator?
I went to San Antonio, Texas, Lackland Air Force Base. I was detached to Camp Bullis, Texas, which was an Army post. And I was in charge of marksmanship specialists that train people how to shoot weapons. Now, you might think that's odd for a trainer, but they knew the technical end of it. I knew the education and the human development end of it. And so the first job for this kid from Alabama was to go to a remote location out in the woods and help people teach other people how to shoot guns all the time. That was a good job.
Did you have a little bit of practice with that? Or?
I might have shot a gun once or twice when I was out there. So M60 machine guns, N203 grenade launchers, 38s, 45s, a lot of fun, but also a great experience, a great leadership experience for me as a young officer to do that. And then the rest of my career was just a continuation of different kind of opportunities to provide professional military education and those kinds of things. As I grew in rank, then I was supervising programs and people that were providing those education and skills training. Spent a lot of time at the Air Force Academy, 11 years of my career, working with young cadets and that kind of thing. So it was a great experience for me.
When did you leap from the military to the civilian world?
In 2000, I was actually stationed at Maxwell Air Force Base and sought the advice of mentors. It felt right for me. I was about to meet the colonel's board, and that would have been another kind of commitment to me. You certainly lose control of your life when you join the military. You ultimately lose control if you're picked up for colonel. I didn't know if that was going to happen or not. I was a lieutenant colonel at the time. I really had to think about whether or not I wanted to continue to do that. So I got some mentoring advice, and I decided to retire at that point. I retired and immediately got a civilian job two buildings over on Maxwell Air Force Base from where I was serving as an active duty Air Force officer. And I spent nine or 10 years as a civilian when this opportunity presented itself.
Okay, and what were you doing as that civilian job for 9 years? What was that?
I had several jobs. The job that I was doing before I came here, I was actually the Associate Vice President for Academic Affairs at Air University. And Air University is the accredited university that provides associate degrees, which is technical degrees just like ours, master's degrees, and even a PhD to Air Force members from around the world. We have resident and distance education programs, and Maxwell is the seat of Air University. So I was at that headquarters at Air University as a part of the senior academic team plotting out strategy and policy for educational programs.
Okay. Where are you from originally?
I was actually born in the state of Washington, but my dad was in the service up there, and his home state was Alabama. So very early when I was young, we returned to Alabama. So I was essentially raised in the state of Alabama.
How old were you when you came back?
I really don't know, probably around three or something like that. So very, very young. Okay. So I have no really memory other than Alabama. Grew up quite a bit in Dothan, Alabama, halfway through junior high school, came to Montgomery, Alabama. So in a sense, Montgomery is I met my wife in Montgomery. We were high school sweethearts. I went to Capitol Heights Junior High School, Robert E. Lee High School, then the University of Alabama after that, then Auburn University after that, then the University of Georgia after that. So, you know, the South is in my blood. I love this state. I love this part of the state. It's great to be here. The people are awesome, and, this was a bucket list thing for me. There's nothing else I want to do.